We're not against rap. We're not against rappers. But we are against those thugs.
Thad, welcome back to School Sucks.
Hey, thanks.
Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
Let's say China. China!
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links, or maps of where you can buy stamps in your area. Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is August 31st, and what a month it was, am I right? Gosh, it's terrific to be able to welcome Thaddeus Russell back to the show. If you're new and you're saying, what is the big deal about this Thaddeus Russell character? Well, I suggest you go to our archives, schoolsucksproject.com. We have a little series drop-down menu. Check out a Renegade History course, or just search the site for Thaddeus Russell. You're going to have a nice time. You're, at the very least, you're going to have an exciting time, even if you don't describe it as nice, because it makes you upset and uncomfortable, some of the things you're going to hear. But man, do I enjoy talking to this guy, and I know a lot of you enjoy listening to me talking to this guy. Thaddeus Russell is the author of a book called A Renegade History of the United States, the themes of which come up several times in the discussion, which centers around the recent film and the recent subject of a Podcast Masters Liberty Masterclass, Straight Outta Compton. So let me begin the monologue by previewing three questions that I'm going to attempt to answer. Number one, does the film Straight Outta Compton tell the truth about NWA? Question number two, and you might have seen this on the group or on our YouTube channel, can libertarians learn anything from NWA or Black Lives Matter or Donald Trump? That ruffled a few feathers, that suggestion. And question three, did I make any mistakes in our discussion? The answer to that one is yes. It's actually the easiest one to answer, so let's address that first. So Thad and I were talking about the Protestant work ethic, which we've talked about several times on the show before. It comes up in the film. It's definitely one of the things that Thad addresses in his book. I made a little mistake, so this is what it was. I said that one of the things that I liked that the film communicated, it seemed like in that time, in that place, in that setting, whence these guys came, Compton, California, there were really like three choices. One, break your back at some shitty job. Two, be on welfare. Or three, be in a gang. Those are the means of surviving. And I thought it was cool that Dre found this other way, which was pursuing this passion. And we contrasted that with his mother, who seemed to be, or I suggested anyway, that she was more of a supporter of the Protestant work ethic. Because at one point in the film, I thought she said, I don't care if you're a janitor, as long as you're the best janitor, which is like, if you ask me. But what she actually said, or what the exchange between her and her son, Dr. Dre, actually was, I don't care if you're a janitor, she said. And then Dre said, as long as I own the company, which is a little different. But at the same time, it's also not exactly like, follow your dreams, son. Follow those dreams. You want to take these DJing talents you have and you want to apply them to this revolutionary rap group that goes on to create hits like Fuck the Police and A Bitch is a Bitch. Mama believes in you. That part should probably get edited out. But if it doesn't, sorry. And the next question, does Straight Outta Compton tell the truth about NWA and its members? Ooh, that question makes me feel kind of uncomfortable. I don't like that language. The truth about. The film conveys many important facts about certain aspects of what was NWA and the members of NWA. Is the story complete? Of course it's not. So I get a little antsy when anyone says they have the truth about a person or an organization or a phenomenon or an event or a time period. Because to any examination like that, we're bringing our own biases, we're bringing our own lenses through which we want to view it. So I'd be more comfortable if somebody said, here is a comprehensive theory about, you know, certain aspects of NWA based on a carefully researched and gathered collection of facts and statistics. That'd be cool. Or here are some truths about NWA, which the film presents, and the film definitely has a very specific focus. What it neglects is interesting. I understand why it leaves certain things out, and we're going to talk about that just briefly here. But if those things had been addressed, totally different and possibly far more interesting, albeit far more lengthy, film might have resulted. When we say we're telling the truth about something, is it the most important truth? What's the most important thing to know about NWA? I think as far as the rap group is concerned, that is covered in the film. But if we look at what's neglected, does it make a more interesting story? And that's kind of the direction we went in the show today versus what we did last week in Podcast Masters. But we still didn't do as full an exploration as I would have liked. But this is the School Sucks Project. We can only devote so much time to Straight Out of Compton. And, you know, one of the characters, Dr. Dre, has a history of alcohol abuse, a history of domestic violence. None of that is addressed in the film. I mean, the film is not solely about Dr. Dre, but one of the things that, as I thought about it more carefully, it bothered me is there's kind of this presentation of heroic visionaries, not people who overcame internal challenges, right? Like all their challenges are externally imposed. Now, in that world, growing up in that kind of environment, maybe in broken families, maybe around drugs, maybe around gangs, especially from a very, very young age, lots of internal challenges. And the film doesn't deal with that. Every challenge is external. MTV, the LAPD. In Podcast Masters, we talked about maybe the role of the CIA affecting things in that part of the world, but all external. So I just think somebody asked me this question. This is why I'm going into this. Do you think the film told the truth about NWA? Because this person I was talking to, she was actually upset that the domestic violence aspect was not addressed. If domestic violence was a result of alcohol abuse, which I think it often is, and that's an added challenge from an internal landscape. I mean, Dr. Dre is like a billionaire, right? He's a billionaire who 35 years ago was a black teenager in Compton, California, in the middle of an LAPD crackdown on black teenagers. It's a cool story, even if it's just the external challenges that are dealt with. But if you add to that the challenges that exist on the internal landscape, that would have been fascinating. So does the film tell the truth? Some truths, some really important truths. And Thad and I will address that question more completely in our discussion, which is coming very soon. The last question. What can libertarians learn? This was also the title of a YouTube video. What can libertarians learn from NWA, Black Lives Matter, and Donald Trump? Well, I would say at this point in my life, with my goals, nothing from any of them. NWA taught me a lot. When I was 16, I am grateful for that. Obviously, you can tell that that group and its members have a place reserved in my heart, that I have a great deal of nostalgia for that time and for that experience in my life. But what can we? I mean, after, like, let's just say we is the audience of this show, and let's just say as the audience of this show, you've listened to every episode and you've kind of sat next to me while I did research for every episode. And what can we learn from Black Lives Matter and Donald Trump? Nothing. Because they choose to participate in this realm called politics. There's nothing for us there. There's nothing positive or productive that can come out of that. So if you watch the video that I put out with this title, this very provocative title, it was completely intentional. This was not a mistake on my part. So Thad's argument is basically that they don't engage in respectability politics. They don't care about being respectful. But they're still doing politics, which is disrespectful, period. Let's have discussions and explorations about how we can use violence to get our way. The political world, I guess I can only speak for myself. The political world has nothing for me. It is not a home field advantage. It's entirely set up to marginalize and essentially disappear from the dialogue people who think like I do. So I'm not interested in going there to introduce my ideas to people in what I agree with that would have to be a pretty shocking and disrespectful way to command their attention. But I don't see that as being productive, right? So I see Black Lives Matter. There's plenty we can learn from observing them, or I guess I should say the behavior of certain members within that hashtag. I think we could learn a lot about psychology from observing Donald Trump. But as far as like purposeful and meaningful actions we can take, they have nothing to teach us. That's my opinion. They have nothing to teach me. We're not interested in doing politics. There's no such... Thad uses this term respectability politics. Politics is not respectable or respectful. Politics is interesting, sure. Blame me. We are against those thugs. But of course, if Donald Trump gets elected president and makes America great again, I'll take all that back. Here's Thaddeus Russell, everyone. Thanks for listening. Take care. It's R-A-W.
Looking at the Grand Wizard, Warlord, vocal cords so vicious. And I don't have to show riches to pull up, pull off with some bad bitches. And it ain't about chivalry, it's about dope lyrics and delivery. It's about my persona, ain't nothing like a man that can do what he wanna. Ain't nothing like a man that you knew on the corner. Seen come up and fuck up the owner. Seen throw up Westside California. Nigga, I'm hot as Phoenix, Arizona. I'm Utah, I got multiple bitches, it's a new law. Keep a hold of your riches, dumb nigga, don't spend it. As soon as you get it and recognize I'm a captain, you a lieutenant. I can say what I wanna say, ain't nothing to it. Gangsta rap made me do it. If I call you a nigga, ain't nothing to it. Gangsta rap made me do it. I can act like an animal, ain't nothing to it. Gangsta rap made me do it. If I eat you like a cannibal, ain't nothing to it. Gangsta rap made me do it.
Thad, welcome back to School Sucks.
Hey, thanks.
I'm very excited that you're back. I'm not the only one. I posted in the group today, and everyone was pretty excited, and a lot of questions came in, too, related to our topic today, this movie Straight Outta Compton. First of all, it's been about a year since you've been on the show. The last time you were on, things got a little bit wild. I pictured it being kind of like a spawning match, but it was 3-on-1, and it felt like a little bit more of an air raid when I edited it. But yeah, you're shaking your head. You did well. You handled yourself well.
I'm sorry you guys were outnumbered.
So, is this your first Straight Outta Compton related interview?
Yes.
Glad we got to you first. Now, I asked that because when I first read Renegade History, I guess maybe it was like the end of 2013, beginning of 2014, you know, I'm in my mid-30s at the time. I'm reading these stories that were obviously well before my time. And as I'm picking up some of the themes in the book, my thought is, over and over again, NWA. Then, when the movie came out and I went to see it with a couple of people who've worked on the show with me, I said, I want to talk to Thaddeus Russell about this movie. On our first pass through it, we recorded a show that was 2.5 hours long. We tied in personal experiences. I came across this music when I was like 16. I was growing up in New Hampshire. We tied in police brutality, the crash program that I'm sure you're familiar with that was going on to counter the gangs at that time, the drug war, how these drugs got into Los Angeles. So this all got wrapped up in this 2.5 hour show that we did. But I felt like it was also quite a bit of hero worship because we were like really pumped up. We had just walked out of the theater, you know? So I went back through your posts, your tweets to see what you had had to say because I was sure you had said something about it. You said you were overwhelmed. Too many things to say for Facebook or Twitter. So what I wanted to know, when all this happened, like I said, I was 16. I was just getting into pot, getting into drinking and partying and stuff like that. It was the first time in my life where I felt like the police were really going to interfere with my ability to have a good time. And my attitude towards them changed. That music was a nice soundtrack for that mindset. And I went into much more detail. You, about 10 years my senior, what was the impact on you when NWA hit the scene in the late 80s?
I was still in college. I'm not sure I heard them until I was right out of college. I can't remember. It was like my senior year or right after that. I was trying to remember that time and my first experience with them. I think I was initially afraid and intimidated, I guess.
Really? Tell me a little more about that. Yeah.
Well, that's what they wanted me to feel.
Yeah.
I mean, not that I thought they were going to come to my house and do anything. No, just the, you know, I guess it's sort of like, it's probably similar to the how I first viewed like a horror movie or something, you know, just I'm sort of scared before I really experienced it, gone into it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was, I remember like looking at the album cover and feeling that, and I guess sort of hearing about it before I'd listened to it, maybe. I really can't remember. This is, you know, 1988, 89. But very quickly, I loved it for the most part. I mean, I've always been ambivalent about it, and we'll certainly talk about that. But I mean, just first of all, the musicality of it. I mean, it's some of the greatest hip hop ever, in my view, just in terms of the music. Mm-hmm. I have always thought Ice Cube might be the greatest rapper of all time. He's always been one of my very favorite rappers. I mean, just the skill, the talent. I think Dre is like possibly, you know, he's one of the greatest American musicians of all time.
Sure.
And I don't think he actually has thought of that way, but I don't think there's any question about that.
I don't think people understand what he's done. They've heard his voice on his solo stuff and collaborating with other people in an NWA, but that music doesn't get a lot of the credit that it deserves as a creative process. So a lot of people don't see what he's done behind the scenes. I was glad the movie gave at least like a glimpse of it, because it's very cool. And for anyone who's ever like dabbled in that world, and obviously it's way easier to do now with like GarageBand than it was using tapes. What a mess. But he did it and he was successful with very little resources. And, you know, I was 16 in 1993, so I never got that first. I mean, I was like playing Little League my first year when NWA started, so that wasn't a part of my scene. We got into Dr. Dre when The Chronic came out. Someone said, oh, if you like Dr. Dre, you'll like Ice Cube. And then I described it on the other show as reverse engineering through the record stores at that time and talking to people. And I guess you know MTV Raps. And lo and behold, these two guys were in the same group together. And then a lot of what they were talking about, like in The Chronic or Ice Cube on Death Certificate, it made a lot more sense. So NWA was like less scary to us, even though it should have been terrifying to me, you know, growing up in suburban New Hampshire. Because we'd seen like, oh, these guys are kind of safe. They made it to MTV. They made it to the mainstream. And we kind of followed them back into the 80s. And that was a really cool experience. So, yeah, I was bringing a lot of emotion into seeing this movie. And I say that because I walked out of it feeling, I guess I'd describe as hero worship. I don't know what your initial impression was like walking out of the theater. Overwhelmed says a lot. But I think as time went on, I said, this is really something that I want to explore from different angles. I want to rethink my first appraisal of them through this movie. I mean, Dre and Cube produced it, so yes, it's going to show them in a positive light. And I think the other thing, because I wanted to do a production about it, I felt like I was sort of superimposing onto them this enlightenment that maybe really wasn't there at the time. You know, like this trailblazing, there's these libertarian themes. They were just doing what they wanted to do. Essentially, you know, like to make a hero, yeah, you have to cleanse out all this stuff. And like I said, it was one of the first things I thought of when I was reading your book. Do these guys qualify as renegades in your opinion?
Yeah. I mean, and also, I think I said this to someone from a libertarian perspective. I mean, so making them into a heroes is not a great idea. I mean, if that means you're going to gloss over all the contradictions,
right,
and be sort of uncritical. Right. And you're going to sort of stop being analytical about who they were. Right. But is there any question that what they did was heroic? I mean, first of all, I'm absolutely convinced that many, 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 possibly most white people in this country first learned about police brutality and the war on drugs from NWA.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm convinced of that. Like a huge percentage of white people in this country first learned about those things from NWA. Well, I mean, that alone is a massive accomplishment, right? Their sort of attitude toward authority is clearly renegade. It's clearly libertarian. They used money that Eazy-E made from dealing drugs illegally to finance the operation when it started.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so they are tremendous entrepreneurs, right? Black market entrepreneurs. What's more libertarian than that? And I don't identify as a libertarian, but I mean, there's no question that they should be in the pantheon somewhere, right next to Murray Rothbard somewhere. I don't know.
I don't know if many of the others in that pantheon would be too excited about having them there, but I agree with what you're saying.
We should talk about that. Most of them would be horrified. Actually, I don't know. I think Murray Rothbard might be sympathetic, but
sure, yeah.
He was much more interesting and complicated, but like his his disciples now would be horrified, most likely, I think. So heroic for sure. You know what? They were also drenched in misogyny and homophobia.
Well, right? Yeah. I mean, that's the thing I want to talk about is that when I talked about before, like superimposing this heroism or this enlightenment onto them through this libertarian lens, that requires a subtraction of people's flaws. And we know from our discussions before and from all the work you've done, that's plenty common throughout the historical narrative, especially with the more traditional lenses of history. The identification of somebody as a renegade doesn't require that cleansing at all. But the movie does that cleansing, right? So there are all these contradictions you feel that aren't being addressed. So yeah, let's start with misogyny and talk about that one.
Yeah, so that's to me the major, major flaw in this movie. I mean, it's worse than a flaw. It's what I think a lot of people want to do is they want to moralize about it and they want to judge NWA and they want to say, well, therefore they're bad. That's uninteresting to me. I don't think it's very useful. What I really want to do, though, is understand their misogyny.
Yeah.
Right? I saw F. Gary Gray, the director, give an interview in which he said, you know what? You're going to come away from this movie understanding why they did what they did. Referring, I'm sure, entirely to what they did vis-a-vis the police, right? And the crooked record label people, right? But there's zero attempt to understand why every single song on that album contains not just misogyny, but violent misogyny.
Yeah.
There is much more violent misogyny on that album than there are references to the police, right? So it's not like Karl Marx, I don't know if you know this, was probably beat his wife.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Right? So it's sort of like, well, does that mean we should dismiss everything Karl Marx wrote? And, you know, I mean, he has problems on his own for other reasons, but that's a silly argument because his misogyny, I don't think, has much to do with his work.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. But in this case, misogyny is central to their work. It is central. It is in almost every other line in their songs, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at Straight Outta Compton, maybe there's like 12 tracks on there and a few like talk skits in between. And it's, I mean, the songs other than like Straight Outta Compton and Gangster, Gangster and Fuck the Police. And even those songs have their lines. Pretty much the rest of the album is kind of about that. And the Niggers for Life album in a couple of years, the only other album they did like a couple of years later is even worse. And I actually went back and listened to the album and I was like, wow, I see why I liked this when I was 16, but this is tough to get through, like tough to get through in some parts.
Yeah, so what most people who sort of lionize them do is they just kind of close their ears to that, right?
Yeah.
Or refuse to think about it and certainly refuse to deal with it seriously. And I think that's because everyone else wants to talk about that only in a moralistic way, right?
Right.
You're bad. Dr. Dre is bad because he talked about killing bitches, right? And because he beat up women actually in his real life. That's not what do we get from that? But I think it's fascinating. I think it's just interesting.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, it sounds like the debate a little bit is like what I call the Thomas Jefferson problem. In public school, we learn that Thomas Jefferson is good because he was the third president and he's on the money and there's statues of him. In college, we learn that Thomas Jefferson is bad because he owned slaves and we never really learn to understand Thomas Jefferson. You know, so it's far away, but it's that kind of idea.
Yeah. Well, okay. For me and a lot of people, like Thomas Jefferson's racism and slave owning status inform almost all of his work. It's all implicated, even in the Declaration of Independence. It's all there somewhere. So again, that doesn't mean therefore we should throw out everything that he ever wrote.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
But it's to complicate it, right? I'm sort of approaching this as an intellectual primarily rather than as someone with a particular political agenda. So that's kind of what I want to do. I just think it's fascinating that that art form, which it is, gangster rap is a particular art form. Misogyny is central to it, right? And so it's a particular expression of masculinity, and it's just not talked about. Like, it's talked about, but it's never in an attempt to understand why they said that stuff and why they continue to say that stuff.
Of course.
The people who succeed, you know, and it's still central in hip-hop.
Yeah. I mean, I would have thought like that it had gotten worse or that the message of the music had kind of been scaled down. And that's something we can get into is that it's a genre that's been co-opted in many ways and sort of taken over and cleansed. It seems that way. But they turned up like, oh, we have money. oh, we have bitches. You know, that kind of a thing got turned up. Well, maybe the message in most cases got turned down. And even the people who are, you know, really talented, like Mos Def, they're not as popular as people who are focusing more on the material side of it, you know, because that's what's appealing to young. And I said that, like I said, what happened? Rap and country music are pretty much using the same marketing, where it's about having things and mistreating women. And that's really, trust me, when I worked with kids, these boarding schools, like kids who were like 14 to 17 years old, they would say, I love rap and I love country.
Yeah.
And I said, well, what's that all about? And then I listened to like the stuff they were listening to, which at the time was like DMX and maybe Biggie. And this was like when Eminem was starting out and country was like Toby Keith. And yeah, it was all the same kind of messages in the music. It was like misogyny and focusing on material things and drinking.
Where is misogyny in country music?
You haven't heard this in this more popular country music?
No.
Toby Keith.
Everything that I've heard is what I would call sort of adolescent romantic sexuality.
Okay.
It's, you know, it's all about how they look in their shorts and doing something unnamed down by the river, you know, which they don't even name. They don't even name it. They never say, you know, we had sex or I fucked her or anything.
No.
It's never explicit, right? So it's that kind of sort of like broadcast network sexuality. It's not even R-rated usually. And I don't hear misogyny. It's all about love. I mean, that's the whole thing about country.
Yeah, this was a pattern, to be fair, and maybe I was looking a little bit too hard for a connection and an explanation of why these kids gravitated towards these two genres of music. Between 2000 and 2002, I picked that up in both of those genres. So is that a rule for both of them as a whole since the 1980s? No, of course not. It was just an observation that I had at the time.
I mean, maybe a little bit in Toby Keith, maybe.
But he was, yeah, and he was the biggest star back then.
But yeah, even there, I don't know. It's not the same as what Ice Cube is saying about women. I mean, come on.
No. I should have defined my terms better. It was similar in that it wasn't portraying women in a positive respect.
Yeah, well.
Okay, so then again, we can move on from there.
I can't stand conflating, you know, every criticism of women with misogyny.
No, that's true. It's a good point.
Just hatred of women as a group, right?
Yeah.
That's a very big, serious thing, which, you know, I think it's completely fair to accuse NWA of that. And many rappers, at least in their public personas. I mean, who knows? And it's another good question. Like, I have no idea what Ice Cube was like or is like in person with women, his attitudes, real attitudes about women, you know. But publicly, Ice Cube is a misogynist. There's no doubt about it.
Why do you think that shows up in the music as much as it does? I mean, I know, like, I've read a little bit about Eazy-E, and, you know, it was saying that the way he presented himself in his music was just completely alien from his true life persona. And that's, you know, reporting, and is it 100% accurate? I don't know. But why is it so strong and forceful in the music, in your opinion?
Well, so that's the question. So I've been thinking about this question for about 25 years.
Yeah.
I really have. And I don't have an answer. First of all, I'm not black. I'm not from Compton. I never really lived in the hood. I lived in a semi-hood in Oakland when I was a kid for a few years. But I'm not black. I'm not a black man. And I've never put any of these people on the couch, you know, or interviewed them or taken certain, you know, I've never done a real study of this. And what is kind of outrageous to me, I could be wrong, but I'm unaware of any serious attempt to understand this. I've seen cultural studies people write about misogyny in rap, but again, from an outsider's perspective, just sort of doing a textual analysis of the lyrics, right?
Yeah.
All we can do is sort of make educated guesses, and I want to be really clear about that. That's all I can ever do on this.
Is just right.
With some knowledge of some things, but I would never, ever pretend to know why they do this. I mean, we do have some facts. We know that I think they at least all the members of NWA, I think all had single mothers.
Yeah.
That's a place to start, at least, trying to understand this, right? Because that's one's relationship with one's mother basically is the template for one's relationship with women generally.
Yeah.
In my view and the view of most psychologists. So you've got to start there. Being a single black mother or a single mother of any color in a place like Compton in the 1970s and 80s is one of the most difficult things I can imagine in this society. And so they probably weren't always nice to their children. I mean, being a mother, a wealthy mother is hard enough. Being a wealthy father is hard enough. But being a single black mother in South LA in the 1970s and 80s, it's really, I can't imagine. There's not much more difficult things in this society to be. And I have to think that really affected their relationships with their children, and it probably affected the ways that their children viewed women. The lack of fathers among African Americans, in African American families, right? Now there's a huge debate about why that is. The fact is plain. I mean, it's something like 80 or 90% of black families have no father. A huge percentage of black people are raised without a father. A huge debate about this. I'm sure you're aware of some of this, on the kind of libertarian and conservative side, the argument tends to be that it's the welfare state that's responsible for that, that perverse incentives were built into the system to break apart families. It's probably part of it. I also think that...
Well, to expand families that are without a mom and a dad, you can... this is another conversation I overheard when I was working with these young people who were mostly from, bad areas or broken homes, is they would say, yeah, you just get your girlfriend pregnant and you get a check.
Right.
So there's these incentives to actually, as a single mother, have more children. I heard a woman in Vermont say one time, quote, "I'm going to keep having kids till the state buys me a house," unquote.
Yeah. So I think that's not wrong. It's not what I think.
Okay.
If you know my work and you know what I have to say about the family, you should probably be able to guess roughly what I have to say about this. The nuclear family is a terrible thing.
A terrible thing? Like across the board?
Yeah. It's a terrible institution, at least in the American model of it, which is...
The island, yeah.
Yeah. We talked about this, didn't we?
Yeah, but go ahead. Just for people who might not have heard that.
I can't remember if we did, yeah. So the model in America... and in most of Europe, but especially in America, you must be father, mother, children, house, and no one else.
Right.
Right. It's the island, right? You are now solely responsible for raising these people. And you're weak and not really what we're looking for as a good American citizen if you rely on anyone or anything else, any other person, any other institution. This is what we have said is the problem with immigrants since the Irish started coming over 200 years ago. They brought the whole family and they lived with the whole extended family and everybody was raising the children. That was one of their big problems, according to, the keepers of American morality. And it was said about the Irish, the Italians, the Jews, and it's been said about blacks too. It's being said about Mexicans and Latin Americans now, immigrants. That is one of their big problems, is they bring over the aunt and the uncle, the grandma and the grandpa, and everybody raises the children. They all live together. As a parent, that sounds really good to me, as a matter of fact. It is the most difficult thing, raising a child and doing it well. And doing it all by yourself, also, by the way, when you have to be making a living outside the house, it's the hardest thing I've ever done, that's for sure. And I'm pretty sure I'm not alone in that. So it's a terrible model, and I think it's why rates of alcoholism and drug addiction and divorce are so high. I think it's because of that. People are basically forced through cultural norms into that model, and it doesn't work for people. It's too difficult. It is just too difficult for most people. To me, that is not an indictment of them who leave it. Right? To me, those are the renegades. Those are the people who are sort of showing and demonstrating that it's better to live in a different way.
So it's a white Protestant American culture, just to recap and tell me if I'm missing anything, that's imposed on people who essentially have other cultural ideas. And when they say, this is the unit that we use here in the United States, in the Western world, this is the unit that we use. We see yours as broken. That's bad. It's kind of something to be ashamed of, but we have incentives for more of them to break set up, like with the welfare state.
Okay, yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah.
So there's a lot of shame in not being in a nuclear family that works. But when you talk about all these immigrant groups coming in with extended families, is that not happening in the Black community? Is it just mom and the welfare state?
So I can't even tell you the number of Black people I have met who were raised by their grandparents.
Yeah.
And aunts and uncles, but especially grandparents. So it's very common. I don't know the numbers on this, but I'm sure, you know, it's a very common among, and again, we have to always have to be class conscious in this stuff. We're talking about Black working class people, not Black middle class people. But for Black working class people, I'm quite sure a large percentage were raised by not just a biological parent.
Yeah.
But then there's poverty too. So, you know, where does the anger come from, we ask, about NWA? Like, why, and why is it directed at women? Living in Compton, living in poverty. And then, of course, the war on drugs. I mean, what a fucking setup, if you think about it, right? I mean, so we make these things illegal, which creates a black market, which makes it amenable only to criminals to enter that market, violent people. That's who you're surrounded by. It's not a nice place. And then you crack down on it with constant police presence. The crash program, which was the worst stop and frisk program possibly in American history, where they pretty much stopped. Well, the movie did a pretty good job of showing that, where they stopped people and frisked them and put them on the ground for doing just about anything.
Yeah. Or not really doing anything.
Yeah, right. Or just looking like or having a Raiders cap on.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So, but that kind of begs the question of why that anger is directed more at women, actually, than, say, the governor of California.
Yeah.
Or the mayor of Los Angeles, right? You know, I don't know, but I just want people to start thinking about why rather than simply judging it or ignoring it, right?
Exactly.
Ignoring it is no good, but judging, the only responses you get are ignoring it and judging.
Right.
That's all you get. I want to know why. Where does this come from?
Okay, so it seems like, for me, it really does come back to, and statistics will show that Black families did start to break up more and more, and more frequently, more single mother households as the welfare state grew through the 60s, through the 70s, through the 80s. And with that, you get part of that scene is that women are, regardless of what responsibility a man might have to a family, if you're talking 3 out of every 4 are just expendable, can be abandoned, even with children, I wouldn't think that would translate to a lot of respect 20 years into the welfare system in the late 1980s.
I've never been 100% sure about how the welfare state compels men to leave. Why is that?
Okay.
I've never actually seen that. What is the logic there?
Okay. So do you think more childbirth is on purpose in this country? And let's do working class and middle class.
No, I understand how you get a check for having a child.
Right.
I get that part. Yeah. But why would that kick the man out?
How many people have children because they want to and they plan to? 1 out of every 2?
You mean people in general?
The man can leave if there's this safety net underneath.
Oh, yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. So, right. So it sounds like,
especially when you factor into it, like, it's already a desperate life. Like, I haven't been in that kind of desperation, but I've been in periods in my life where things were not good. And if suddenly a girl that I was sleeping with came to me and said, "Oh, now I'm pregnant," that would have been like a major tragedy. And to think that, like, "Oh, well, here, just do what everybody else we know does, and right, I'm going to scoot." If somebody doesn't want to take personal responsibility and they're maybe not even resourceful enough to take personal responsibility, that's a nice out, I think.
So what you're saying to me is that the men, generally speaking, the men who do stay, do so through compulsion.
No, I think it's really hard to make generalizations about that. I think it comes down to the individual. It's really, really hard to make rules for this.
What you're saying, and I'm not even arguing with you
sure
at all, I'm just saying, it sounds to me like what you're suggesting is that when given the chance to leave, men will leave. That when there is not the economic necessity, right, is removed,
mm-hmm,
they will leave.
I think so, a certain type of man, almost even regardless of socioeconomic status or ethnicity or race, if the person is low self-esteem because of a bad family background, if they're desperate, not just financially, but also maybe in an emotional sense, if they fear for their own survival, if they don't feel capable or resourceful of being responsible for other people or even themselves, yeah, if there's escape hatches from this situation, I think that people in that situation, as so many people living in the inner city often are, they would jump through the hatch.
So, I mean, it tells me that the nuclear family is a hard place to live.
Well,
regardless of economic status, regardless. There is all kinds of alcoholism and affairs and adultery and divorce in rich families too. It's a hard place to live, man. You haven't done it yet, right?
No, I mean, I have one in my past that didn't work out, and it was a beautiful little, it was like a kind of a nice, you know, suburban or even somewhat like rural upper middle class kind of situation. We had beautiful bushes out front. It was a gorgeous house. Yeah, and it didn't work for us.
You had bushes and it didn't work. That's amazing.
Beautiful bushes. Yeah.
Yes, same for me. My mother split. Well, my mother, interestingly, mm-hmm. My mother split when I was 5, and then I got a divorce when my son was 7.
Yeah.
So I've been on both ends. Yeah.
And so my parents never split. That was the worst part.
Oh.
They just said, you know, like so many people do, they say, this is for the children.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Like the state says, you know.
Exactly.
And they didn't get divorced till I was like, I forget exactly. I was between 20 and 22 when they finally got divorced.
So then what was the problem?
They hated each other my whole life.
Okay. And it was obvious that they did?
My dad, when I was young, my dad made a lot of money and that quieted their disdain.
Okay.
You know, like that pacified the hatred.
You were aware of it.
Yeah, especially like when my mom had to go back to work. Yeah, that's when things really started to become more vocal and more visible and, you know, fights about like when I was 14 and I'm like, why are adults fighting about what the thermostat should be set to and how much shit should be in the dishwasher when it runs?
Yeah.
That seems silly.
Yeah.
It deteriorated pretty quickly after the financial situation was.
So what I'm saying is that is normal.
Absolutely. It's at least half.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I took a poll of my students last semester. There were about 30 of them. How many of their parents were divorced? How many were separated, et cetera? It was more than half. And what was interesting was how cynical they were about their parents' relationships.
Yeah.
I mean, a couple of them, of course, said they loved each other, but, you know, they were like, oh, yeah, they haven't talked to each other in 20 years. I can't even imagine them having sex. And, you know, it's not a pretty picture. It's not a pretty picture. And I'm suggesting it's the model of the nuclear family is primarily responsible for that. A and B, I'm also suggesting that black men who have left ain't perfect, but I think at least in part what is going on there is a rebellion, a tacit rebellion,
mm-hmm.
not an explicit one, but a tacit rebellion against the nuclear family. I can't prove it because we never talk to these guys. But I'm pretty convinced of that. And at least I'd like to think, I think we should at least think about it in that way. That it is a fleeing from something that we should examine.
I understand that.
So that rather than examining the guys, which we do plenty of, or at least we moralize against them, let's try to figure out why they would leave this thing in droves.
I understand that. I also...
Go ahead. So one, you know, there's several answers to that, none of which are satisfying to me. One is just the racist answer. Well, they're black and they're bad and they're not, you know, they're not suited to be family people. And then there's the welfare state answer, which is so-so, but it doesn't really do enough for me. And then I don't even know what the sort of left-wing liberal answer is. I'm not even sure.
Liberal? That was what my point was going to be. For the people out there who might be new to our conversations, there was this group of people called the progressives. They said, these family unit things, that's terrifying. We need to get in there and break those up. And people could argue that they did.
Progressives were anti-family?
Especially, you know, feminists like Rhianne Eisler. We just dealt with this for hours on my show. We promote this communication methodology called nonviolent communication. We were attacked for it. We were accused of basically being useful idiots in mind control. and that this was all like a second wave feminism plot to break up families. You know, I mean, you don't see any attempts by second wave feminism towards the dissolution of the family.
Okay. Well, that's not the original progressive.
No. Okay. Yeah. Sure. I should have been more clear about that.
The original progressives were totally pro nuclear family.
Christian without God. Yeah.
Yeah. Second wave feminism. No. Overall, not even there. In terms of the mainstream feminists, if you look at Betty Friedan's book. Which you should, because it's horrifying in lots of ways. But no, it's all about sort of restructuring the family and simply sort of redistributing the pain within it.
Okay. I mean, so let me change my language again. Maybe instead of breaking apart the family, a better idea would be breaking into the family, taking control of the family.
With the state, you mean? You're talking about welfare statism?
Yeah. And even the state becoming more of a mother and father than the biological mother and father.
Right. So Friedan and company, one of their major policy platforms was nationally funded childcare centers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. So there you go. I mean, so where the extended family becomes the state. Yeah, totally. But for them, the objective was, though, to uphold the family, to keep it together, right? And, of course, to make it egalitarian, which was their major mission.
Yeah.
To make the family egalitarian so that we all suffer equally within it.
Right.
Anyway,
that's misogyny. We could actually, there's a couple other themes in the movie that I wanted to hit on. I don't think we solved that one, but yeah, that's definitely a good investigation.
So, yeah. When I said I was overwhelmed by the movie, I mean, it was one of the first things that struck me about it about midway through was just how complicated the story is and how complicated the movie is and about how complicated my feelings about it are. There's so much going on. It's a 2.5 hour movie. It's a biopic, sort of this, it's a pretty in terms of form and structure, it's a pretty standard biopic and tone, I would say. It's a pretty standard Hollywood biopic. But first of all, it's a multiple biopic. It's stories of basically at least five people. You could say six. Yeah, six, because you've got the Giamatti character as well. There's stuff about Los Angeles in the 1980s. There's stuff about police brutality generally. There's stuff about the black family in there. There's stuff about misogyny in there, kind of elliptically, I would say. There's just so much going on. But what struck you? What's interesting?
Well, I thought there were some similar themes that or things that stuck out as themes for me from A Renegade History of the United States that when I first read it, tied it to NWA for me, from my experience. So one of them was the work ethic. And I thought a neat thing about this story. The first time we did a show in that series that I called A Renegade History Course, the opening song in the first episode was Straight Out of Compton. I don't know if you ever heard any of the produced shows. People say they're marvelous. So if you ever get a chance, you could check them out.
Okay.
All edited and, you know, little clips and bumpers added. The outro song for that first episode was Gangsta Rap Made Me Do It.
Wow.
And Ice Cube has a line in that song, use your brain, not your back. Use your brain, not a gat. And that's, yeah, I mean, it sounds like if you don't think about it, that sounds, yeah, like a line in a rap song. But you have this place where, from what I've gathered, there was very, very little hope. There was very, very little sense for most people of upward mobility.
Right.
Now, Dre, as a late teenager, early 20s, gets slapped by his mom for saying, I don't want to work a bullshit job.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, after she's saying, do you know how hard I've worked?
Right.
To provide this for you.
But then
they go outside, right? And it's not that nice, you know? So he sees that as, well, you know, I love my mom, but she's kind of a sucker, you know, for working that hard for this.
Yeah.
And I think he sees, I think through people like Easy, who's a drug dealer and isn't rich but has a little bit of money, that there are other opportunities. So there's get ahead through violence, survive by breaking your back, and then they kind of find this third way of actually pursuing a pleasure to become insanely rich. Mm-hmm. And I love that story in that context.
Sure.
You know, because who else, and just that we talked about this in the last show I did, how excited people in that area, at least in the movie, seemed to be for them. And maybe there was some of that in real life. Who the fuck had ever done that in Compton? You know, going from like a mediocre inner city neighborhood, as far as inner city neighborhoods go, to Billboard, to going on tour, to being on MTV, getting banned from MTV in what, 2 years? Less than 2 years? Yeah. It's an amazing story. So I think that it's an interesting twist on the Protestant work ethic. Dre's mom buys into it, but he kind of knows it's bullshit. But he also knows, from what I picked up in interviews, like they did an interview like in the late 80s when they were saying, hey, you guys are promoting gang violence. And Dre said, this ends in either jail or you're dead. So like, I think he understood that. And he also knew that the play by the rules strategy was bullshit. And they found this third way. And I would have even liked to see that be emphasized more in the movie than it was. But I mean, I think it comes through.
So the Puritan work ethic.
Protestant work ethic, I guess it's called.
It's interchangeable.
Okay.
It's used interchangeably, which is fine with me. But Puritan or Protestant work ethic says, right, work in itself, no matter what you gain from it, is virtuous.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you should work no matter how much money you get.
Right.
Right. No matter what material benefits accrue from it. That I didn't hear Dre's mother saying that. She's simply saying, you got to work. I have to work to keep a roof over your head. And I'm not going to, I mean, I sort of took this as implicit, you know, I'm not going to deal drugs because that's either dangerous or it's not respectable. I mean, you know, one of the problems with the movie, and this is tied into its lack of attention to misogyny, is, you know, there's not, the women in it are pretty slim. The female characters are pretty undeveloped, but she's not espousing a Puritan work ethic.
Well, she says something like, when you say work for the sake of work, she does say something to him like, I don't care if you're a janitor, as long as you're the best janitor. Pretty sure.
You know who said that almost exactly, word for word? Martin Luther King.
Well, wouldn't that make sense?
You just paraphrased Martin Luther King, a very famous speech that's in Renegade. Yeah.
And she might have been, I think she starts to say it, and he kind of like says, as long as I'm the best janitor, I think it's something like that.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, that's almost exactly what King said about mm-hmm. street sweepers.
That's probably how Dre knew to finish the quote, because she probably said it to him all the time.
Wow.
Yeah.
Huh. I've only seen the movie once, but anyway, yeah. But yeah, sure. I mean, God, I love that scene nonetheless. I mean, I love breaking free and seeing that you can have a better life simply by not playing by the rules. I mean, of course, this is like, you know, but this is like a standard trope in not just American movies, but in American fiction and, you know, TV shows. But it's nice to see a poor black kid in Compton in 1984 say it rather than your typical Hollywood star saying it, right?
Yeah.
So I love that. I mean, because, again, those guys had more obstacles and less to work with than anyone else in the society. Anyone else in the society.
Yeah. So we could talk about another one if you want to move on.
Sure, yeah.
To a third theme. It comes through is kind of an imperviousness to being shamed.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So you have black community leaders, black preachers. You've heard the, we're not against rap. We're not against rappers, but we are against these thugs, right? And that guy, Calvin, I forget what his last name was. He was on a crusade by...
Was it Calvin Butts?
But that, yes. Yes, it was.
Was he in the movie?
No, but... We know the quote from the Bone Thugs and Harmony, thuggish, ruggish bone. It's at the beginning of the...
Yeah, but Calvin Butts, very prominent black pastor in New York.
Yeah.
He kind of was one of the leaders of the clerical anti-rap movement of the 80s and 90s. Yeah.
Yeah. So that quote from that Bone Thugs song was him. And he was talking, I mean, that was a little bit later. He was talking about Flavor Flav shooting at somebody, Tupac supposedly sodomizing somebody, and Snoop Dogg at the murder thing.
Right.
So, you know, calling them thugs. But before that, you had Jesse Jackson speaking out against it. And I thought, seeing that in the movie and thinking about your book, I say, oh, that's what that is. That's a kind of heroic imperviousness to shame. But then I started thinking, like, do money and fame and women just make you really not give a shit about what some preacher might say? When you know it doesn't really matter what the black community leaders say when you're taking a limo out of the black community, you know? I don't know.
I'm sure it helps.
Yeah.
So first of all, so the the politics being put forward by Calvin Butts, Jesse Jackson and company, and Al Sharpton, by the way, was also a leader in this. And Sharpton was leading marches on record label companies as of like 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah, boycotts.
Boycotts. Right. So, by the way, Jesse Jackson started that, leading a campaign against disco in the 1970s. No one knows about that, but he had a whole movement against disco. It was big, a national movement.
That's awesome.
same reason, right? Same stuff, because it was too sexual and too violent and blah blah blah. So that kind of politics is very much part of a long lineage in black, what I would call sort of mainstream politics. Martin Luther King espoused it. Frederick Douglass did. Abolitionists did. It's called, now we call it respectability politics. And by the way, one of the very interesting things lately is Black Lives Matter activists have kind of very explicitly rejected respectability politics. They use that term and they say, we are not respectable.
Okay.
So I actually, I'm sure a lot of your listeners are not as fond of them as I am, but I'm pretty excited about them. Some of them, especially the ones in Seattle. I don't know, the ones who disrupted Bernie Sanders. Have you seen that?
Yeah. And still, I see something like that and my reaction is to be just extremely put off by it.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of shit in the world that I don't understand. There's a lot of people who are living lives that I don't know what it feels like to live that life. So I see something like that. This part of me says, well, gosh, that's disruptive. You know, that's not respectable.
Exactly.
And maybe that part exists in you too. Yours is quieter than mine. Maybe that part is gone.
When I first saw the video, I was kind of like clenched with angst about it. There was something in me. Absolutely. You know, I was just deeply bothered by it. And the more I thought about it, and then more importantly, you should absolutely read and listen to her interviews in the week after that. She's very, very smart. And libertarians have a lot to learn from her. I'm forgetting her name. But anyway, it's the woman who was sort of the leader of that, the two of them, the one who actually spoke. She's very, very smart and very pro-freedom in some really important ways. So first of all, the Bernie Sanders thing, just as an aside here, what was the guy? This was not like a free exchange of ideas among civilians, right? That they disrupted. What was he doing? What was he about to do? He was about to give a speech, right?
Yeah.
So that in pursuit of holding, right, the most powerful position in the government in the history of the world, right?
Incidentally, to become the third person in the United States history to hold that job, to not also meet the same membership criteria for the Ku Klux Klan, being a Jew.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
Okay. Kennedy and Obama before him.
You know what I mean? So it was a statist thing, first of all. Libertarians need to understand that. It was a statist thing that they disrupted, so I got no problem with that. Marching into like brunch restaurants on a Sunday morning and chanting, I'm not into that at all, you know? Or, you know, again, like if it was sort of like this free exchange of ideas or something and they, you know, like a panel discussion on some topic, right? Mm-hmm. If they disrupted that, I'd be less interested. But fuck it, guy's running for president, you know? And by the way, I was just listening to Lou Rockwell and Tom Woods talking about Donald Trump today.
Okay. Yep.
No, I know. No one's perfect, okay? Nothing and no one is perfect. But their major point about Donald Trump, I agree with, which is he's not respectable. He's not boring. He says what he wants to. And politics, electoral politics in this country, but politics generally, is constrained. The way we talk about and think about politics is constrained by that, by respectability. You're not allowed to say certain things, right? Which is a very, very conservative force. It stops us from thinking outside the box, right? It is the box in many ways, right? So just saying what you're not supposed to say, even if it's about Mexicans or women's periods, it allows for freedom for all of us in terms of what we can say politically.
Yeah, it's ventilation. Exactly.
It's more than that. I mean, it just opens up holes that we can, you know, fill with other ideas. So
that's true. Yeah.
So respectability politics. Yes, that's what the opponents within the Black community. I hate that term. I can't believe I just used it.
Yeah.
Such thing. I take that back. The Black opponents of NWA. That's what they were playing. They were playing respectability politics, and that's what NWA was flouting. You know, which is great.
That made up some of the most powerful scenes in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? And I love that the movie begins with the battering ram.
Yeah, it kind of has to. I mean, I would have liked... It was interesting how they were just kind of cutting to these asides about what was going on in Los Angeles, like where these guys came from. So you have the crash program, and then I think at the time they're running something called Operation Hammer, where they're really turning it up. That's where the battering rams come in. And I don't know if you've ever seen like the photo ops with Nancy Reagan in her war on drugs, riding in the battering ram with Daryl Gates.
Oh, wow. No.
Yep. And she says, I just wish we could have gotten to them sooner, but yeah. Now we're in the battering ram. And then what they predicted with the Rodney King thing and then the riots. And when we made the show, I kind of started assembling it using my normal thought process. It's like anti-welfare, it's anti-police. And I said, I want to find somebody on the other side taking some responsibility. I don't want to make a narrative that is all about, look at what victims these people are, because other people have tried to do that and they right. suck and they wind up having some really bad ideas right. and doing some really bad state policies because of that. So I find myself doing that. Look at how bad the LAPD are. Look at government at least turning its back, at very least turning its back as cocaine floods these cities in the mid-1980s out of Nicaragua. Mm-hmm. I needed the Jesse Jackson clip that I used in the show, and I needed the Calvin Butts clip because I needed some conflict to say, hey, there's responsibility in these neighborhoods for this too. The best clip that I found was Freeway Ricky Ross. You know mm-hmm. who he is? Are you down with that whole story? Okay, good. So,
I don't take it all the way.
There's degrees.
Yeah, exactly. But okay. Sure, clearly something was going on there.
Yeah, so he's being interviewed in prison. The interviewer says to him, do you know what has happened in Los Angeles because of this drug crack? And he said, yeah, families are breaking apart. People are getting killed. People are in jail. And the interviewer says, how much responsibility do you take for that? And he says, a lot. And it wasn't like, it's not the perfect summation of the whole situation, but like, there it is. Wow. Personal responsibility. Mm. You know, this is a very complex problem. So I cheered when I found that clip and put it in towards the end of the show because I didn't want to present a story that was about victims. I don't like thinking in those terms.
I hate it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know what to say.
Well, a podcast is different than a college lecture.
Well, no. I mean, I'm just talking about like agency and victimhood in the war on drugs.
Okay.
And Black communities, right? Victims, I hate using that. But then again, I mean, those people... felt the boot of the state more powerfully than any of us did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's the thing you've got to address. Does that mean they were victims? You can use that word if you want. I mean,
it just produces a mentality. Yes, the state is an aggressor. That is like a super aggressive version of the aggressor.
Sure.
For sure. Does that mean that these people have to be labeled as victims and treated as such? Exactly.
I agree with you there. Yeah, yeah. Right. So NWA, not victims.
Exactly.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So they just like drive a truck right through that narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Which is great. I really wish they had spent more time with each of them in the movie. I wish there had been sort of more careful examination of each guy.
Yeah.
And his psychology. That's another failing. But again, it's sort of like, you know, it's hard to tell that whole story and the story of five people or six people in 2.5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting things is, and this is kind of where you started, is white people's response to it, and in particular, white, I think young white men, like you and I at that time. I mean, you were a teenager. I was like in my early 20s.
Yeah.
Yeah, we love it. We get off on it. A lot, most of us, I would say, right? I mean, NWA, I'm sure, is far more popular among whites, in particular, probably white, I'm guessing white men, than any other demographic. I bet you young white men have bought that album way more than any other demographic. What do you think of that?
By the time I found it, it seemed safe. It was exciting. And I talked about this before, like trying to make sense of that world from 3,000 miles away, an alien civilization, basically. Yeah. Inner city Los Angeles from Brentwood, New Hampshire, you know, a town of 1,200 people, 100% white. I guarantee it.
Yeah,
I guarantee it. In the late 1980s when I was growing up. And
you weren't attracted to it because it was safe. You were attracted to it because it was dangerous.
But from a safe distance.
Yeah, dangerous in a particular way. Yeah,
like Compton wasn't attractive to me, you know? Like I remember almost pissing my pants in downtown Manhattan in like 1989 because this homeless guy came up to me. He said, "You got any money?" I said, I was like, 12. Mm-hmm. And we were by Central Park, like outside the Plaza Hotel. Big black guy like hovering over me like I'm just in his shadow. I said, "I don't have any change." That's what I said. I said, "I don't have any change." And he said, "I need the dollars," and yelled at me. And I just almost pissed and shit myself, right? I liked danger from a super safe distance, and I think it provided that. But also there was like a context. Like it was hard for me to make sense of what was really going on because it was so far away and because it was like a different culture. But by 1993, when I found NWA, it was like this backing up project through like the solo work of Eazy-E, Ice Cube, and Dr. Dre. Plus we had Yo MTV Raps. Plus we had In Living Color, and the LA riots and the Rodney King thing had already happened. So by the time I got to Straight Outta Compton, it was like, oh, this isn't shocking. This makes sense. You know, I've heard The Chronic. I've heard Ice Cube. I've watched In Living Color. I've seen the news.
You didn't come to NWA until they had been out for several years.
Right. So I wasn't hit with it. You know, the same way I think that this message, and I wish this had been talked about or addressed, is going to be lost on a lot of kids who even like, I don't know. I mean, when I was 22 and I started working in that boarding school, kids were listening to DMX. So this is like 5 years out of me being into NWA and Dr. Dre and all that. You know, and I remember like fighting with my dad about stuff when I was 16 and being like, when I'm an adult, I'm still going to be cool. You know, when I'm 40 years old, when I'm my dad's age, I got to this school and I listened to these kids like listen to DMX, and I was 21 or 22 and I was like, wow, I'm already not cool. If this is what's cool, this DMX, this is scary.
Yeah.
You know?
But you liked it, right?
No. And
I thought you liked NWA and you liked Eazy-E and you
I did, but by watching these kids like it, right, there was a proximity because they were all from the inner city. They were all from Baltimore, Providence, Rhode Island, Washington, D.C. It was the first time in my life where I had ever been in a social situation where I was the minority. And then, like, you know, Juvenile and the Cash Money Millionaires and, like, a 14-year-old Lil Wayne appear on the scene. And I'm like, what happened to this genre? You know, now it's all just about money and bitch. It's not about, there's no message anymore.
Oh.
Back that ass up.
Yeah, okay.
That's the best. That's what we're doing in 2001.
Well, hang on now. That is a message.
That is a message, yeah.
It is certainly anti-Puritan.
Okay, yeah.
No, right? I mean, yes. So opposition of Puritanism still remains. The vanguard of it still remains, I'd say, in hip-hop.
I definitely agree with.
And that is a very good thing. Again, it's complicated. It's not perfect. I don't like all of it, especially lately. I mean, just aesthetically. But also the message. I don't like all of it either. I mean, I hate the homophobia, maybe even more than the misogyny. Here's something to think about in terms of the misogyny and homophobia. It's not exactly a defense. Maybe it's a defense of it. The misogynist and homophobic thoughts expressed in rap, are those thoughts exclusive to those rappers?
No.
Meaning, are they the only men who think those things?
No. And I mean, I just think that like women, gay people, they're just targets of hostility. So the same way anybody could be a target of hostility, people have hostility to get rid of.
So the ideas expressed, the feelings about women and gays expressed by Ice Cube and MC Ren, etc., are those ideas that you think are in the minds of middle class white men?
Yes.
Yeah, me too. I think they are normal, standard, common among men of all colors and races and classes. So Therefore, what's the difference between MC Ren and, frankly, you and me?
Well,
he says it. We don't. He's more honest than we are. This is their argument. This is what they said they're doing. And I respect that. They called it what they did not gangster rap. They called it reality rap.
Yeah.
They are expressing what they feel inside. And what they felt inside, I think, is common among almost all men. Well, is it better to know what men think about women and gays, etc.? Or is it better to not know? So the repression that is at the core of Puritanism, and I would say just sort of white middle-class culture generally, it's very dangerous, right? Is it any wonder that almost all the mass shooters, serial killers in this country have been white men? You know, I don't think that's an accident. I think they suffer from the repression more than anyone else.
There's an expectation that they'll bottle it better.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what being a good man is, right? You have no emotions. You have no, except for anger. Anger is the only one that's allowed, right?
Yeah.
That's okay. But any other emotion, it's not okay. It's not okay to express that. It's terrifying. The thought of like crying in public for a man is like terrifying.
This is why I think one of the reasons too why politics seems so useful is it's like a civilized outlet for trauma, pain, and anger.
Yeah.
Oh, there's gays, immigrants, bang, bang. I feel better now.
Yeah,
you know?
I agree with you. I actually, even though I'm obviously a very political person, I've said this for a long time. To me, all politics, all political discourse is simply projection of internal drama.
Perfect.
That's really all it is. That goes for everything I've ever said. That goes for everything I've ever said about foreign policy or Obamacare or the welfare state or any of that shit. It's all really at the end of it. Doesn't mean it's invalid and shouldn't be listened to and taken seriously, but there's no other explanation for why I care. Really?
Yeah.
It's some, I don't know exactly what it is, but it's some projection of internal drama.
Yeah.
I have a very important recommendation, reading recommendation for you and all of your listeners.
Cool.
It's one of the greatest articles I've ever read. It's by my friend Shane Lee, Shane, S-H-A-Y-N-E, Lee, L-E-E. He is a sociologist at the University of Houston. The title, it's Huffington Post. Wow, it's only 2 years old. The title is Lil Wayne, Shakespeare, and Artistic Freedom. Shane wrote this in response to Lil Wayne back then. There's a line in one of his songs about Emmett Till.
Yep.
I beat the punk up like Emmett Till, or I beat the pussy or something. Something, anyway.
Jeez. Oh gosh, that's dark. Listen, see, that's...
Yeah, that's
my loudest voice.
Well, that was the reaction by many people to it. And Shane then wrote this great article. I think it's a great article.
So Emmett Till was this, just for people who don't know that story, my uncle is actually working on a movie about this story. As long as I'm thinking of the same guy, he was kind of forced in a supermarket to approach a young black man forced in a supermarket by a group of white people about the same age, maybe a little older, to whistle at a white woman, and then he was basically murdered because of it. So he was set up to be murdered in the South. In the 60s?
1955. But, well, yeah, I mean, in being forced to whistle, I don't know about that. I think he probably just whistled at a white girl, but he was being set up to. Yeah, he was essentially beaten to death.
Yeah.
He was actually from Chicago. He was in the Deep South. I think it was Alabama. Bama or Georgia, I can't remember which state, but it was a Deep South state, and he was beaten to death by some white men who didn't take kindly to that. And he became kind of a catalyst for much of the civil rights movement. The image of his face was put in all the black newspapers and magazines, and it really stirred a lot of people to sort of join the civil rights movement at the time.
Yeah, his mother did an open casket. At his funeral, after he had been basically set on fire, his tongue had been cut out, like just absolutely gruesome, gruesome.
So he's very much, and I'm not denigrating him, but he's very much a Jesus figure among sort of in African American culture.
Sure.
Right. And so to say anything like what Lil Wayne said about him was just, again, crashing through respectability politics in kind of the least permissible way. And he was widely criticized for this. And then, so Shane Lee wrote this article in which he does this fabulous history of equally or even less respectable lyrics and lines from Shakespeare and Edgar Allan Poe and sort of all these great works of Western literature. And he'll show it, you'll see when you read it that what Lil Wayne said is sort of standard, actually, in the Western canon, and that the way that some of the greatest writers in Western history express themselves was equally non-respectable. So anyway, it's definitely worth a read.
Awesome. So we covered everything on my list. Thank you so much for all of your time. It was great to have you back, like I said before. And, you know, speaking of like white middle-class men having to bottle things up, I worry about you sometimes not having like your own podcast. I think you'd really benefit from just every day, not every day, but every week being able to vent for half an hour about the shit that you're observing in the world. I know Twitter and Facebook are very limiting. So I was actually talking to Carlos, who we've done plenty of shows together before. And I said, well, I'm going to pitch this to Thad. If once a month he wants to come on, we don't even have to talk. We'll just sit here and listen to him. And he can go for a half hour about whatever's on his mind. So, you know, you always have an invitation here if you want it. You're easily one of our most popular, even if somewhat divisive, guests ever. And the conversations and debates that you've generated have been so great for this show. So I'm endlessly grateful.
Cool. Sure. Thanks a lot. It's been fun.
Thad, can you give us your website and anything else you want people to know about or you want to plug?
Yeah, my kind of lame-looking website is ThaddeusRussell.com. But I'm active on Twitter, Facebook. I'll friend you on Facebook. Unless you use ad hominem arguments, I don't like that at all.
Sure.
And I'm working on a book, sort of a sequel to Renegade History. It's called Blood and Freedom, A Renegade History of America Abroad.
Yeah.
Looks at American popular culture around the world over the last 150 years. And its subversive influences on authoritarian regimes all over the place. And I'm hoping to finish the manuscript for that this coming winter, and then going to embark on several projects, one of which is exploring the possibility of doing my own podcast.
Awesome. Well, we would be happy to let you practice here as much as you want in the meantime. Thanks again, and hopefully we'll talk again soon.
All right, man. Thank you.
Fuck the police coming straight from the underground. A young nigga got it bad, call him brown. Not the other color, so police think they have the authority to kill a minority. Fuck that shit, cause I ain't the one for a punk motherfucker with a badge and a gun to be beaten on. Thrown in jail, we can go toe-to-toe in the middle of the cell. Fucking with me, cause I'm a teenager with a little bit of gold and a pager. Searching my car, looking for the product, thinking every nigga is selling narcotics. You'd rather see me in the pen than me and Lorenzo rolling in the Benzo. Beat the police out of shape when I'm finished. Bring the yellow tape. Two tape off the scene of the slaughter. Still getting swole off bread and water. They be fags of what they search a nigga down and be grabbing his nuts. And on the other hand, without a gun they can't get none. But don't let it be a black one and a white one. They'll slam you down to the street top. Black police showing out for the white cop. Ice Cube will swarm on any motherfucker in a blue uniform. Just cause I'm from the CPT. Punk police are afraid of me. A young nigga on a warpath, and it's gonna be a bloodbath of cops dying in L.A. Yo, Dre, I got something to say. Fuck the police. Fuck the police. Fuck the police. Fuck the police. And Ren said it with authority. The niggas on the street is still a majority of gang is. With whoever I'm stepping in, the motherfucking weapon is kept in a stash box from the so-called law. Wishing Ren was a nigga they never saw. Lights start flashing behind me. They scared of a nigga, so they mace me to blind me. But the shit don't work, and I just laugh, cause it gives them a hint not to step in my path. For the police I'm saying, fuck you punk. Reading my rights and shit, it's all junk. Pulling out a silly puzzle so you stand with a fake ass badge and a gun in your hand. Take off that gun and we'll see what's up. We'll go at it, punk, and I'ma fuck you up. Make you think I'm gonna kick your ass, but drop that gat. And Ren's gonna blast, cause I'm sneaky ass fuck when it comes to crime. I'ma smoke them now, not next time. Smoke any motherfucker who sweats me, or any asshole who threatens me. I'm a sniper, with a hell of a scope, taking out a cop or two they can't cope, or something like that. It all depends on the size of the gat. Taking out a police will make my day, but a nigga like Ren don't give a fuck to say. Fuck the police. Fuck the police. Fuck the police. Sweating my gang while I'm chilling at the shack. It's shining a light in my face, and for what? I guess it's because I kick so much, but I kick ass. Or because I blast on a stupid ass nigga when I'm playing with the trigger of an Uzi or an AK. Yeah, the police always got something stupid to say. They pull out my picture with silence, cause my identity by itself causes violence. Well, I'm the E with the criminal behavior. Yeah, I'm a gangster, but I still got flavor. Without a gun and a badge, what you got? Just a sucker in a uniform waiting to get shot by me or another nigga. Put a gat, it don't matter if he's smaller or bigger, cause size ain't shit, he's from the old school fool. And y'all all know he's here to rule. Whenever I'm rolling, keep looking in the mirror, and ears on cue, yo, so I can hear a dumb motherfucker with a gun. And if I'm rolling off the eight, then he'll be the one that I take out and then get away. As I'm driving off laughing, this is what I'll say. Fuck the police. Fuck the police. Fuck.